This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. Glad to have you with us this morning. My name is David Inge. The producers for this show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking in general and perhaps also specific terms about medical ethics. Modern medical technology, the technology that doctors have today, the tools that they have today, give them the ability to do things that their forebears could only have dreamt of. At the same time, though, with these tools come questions about how and when they should be applied. And I suppose, in a sense, some of these questions aren't really new. They're the things physicians have always dealt with. But they are very basic and sometimes difficult questions about when you start treatment and when you stop and what is in the best interest of the patient and how you decide whether you're doing more harm than good. And then perhaps layered on top of that are all the questions that do come with modern technology and modern institutions that provide health care. Our guest in this hour is Dr. Mark Siegler. He's the Lindy Berman Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. He's professor in the Department of Medicine. He's also director of the McLean Center for Clinical Medical Ethics. It was established in 1984 at the University of Chicago, and it was one of the first in the nation devoted to this clinical specialty. And at that time, Dr. Siegler was appointed as the director. And since then, the center has trained more than 180 physicians and nurses, many of them now directing programs at leading U.S. and Canadian medical schools. He's here in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk on bioethical challenges in a 21st century world. This is part of the MillerCom series. Over the years, we've had many of these speakers here on the program so that people who are outside of Champaign-Urbana who could not attend this talk can still hear them and hear some of their ideas and be a part of the conversation. He'll be giving his talk this afternoon, 4 o'clock, at the ballroom in the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on the campus that's on South Lincoln in Urbana. And these programs, they're always open to the public and free, and anyone who would like to attend is welcome. Here on the program, though, anyone who would like to call in and ask questions is welcome, too. We just ask, the only thing we ask is people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But questions are welcome, and we certainly do encourage the participation of listeners in the conversation. In Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you are welcome to call. Well, Dr. Siegler, thank you very much for being here.
I am delighted to be here, Dave. Thank you.
There are many, many things we could talk about, and I think one that we were just chatting a little bit before we got going here is the way that now ethical issues, this kind of education, is folded into the general education of the doctor. And I would imagine that some people would ask the question, make the observation, you know, there is so much that people have to learn in the course of their medical education. And they might ask this question, well, you know, if someone's not an ethical person to start, if you spend a couple of weeks in the classroom with them, I say, you know, how much time can you possibly devote to this when you've got to do your anatomy and you've got to do your biochemistry and your microbiology and your everything else that they have to learn? You know, really, I mean, how exactly does this facet of education fit in with all of the vast amounts of other stuff that it is you're trying to cram in these people's heads?
It takes up a very small part of the more general education. Yeah. For exactly the reasons that you said, medical education is increasingly so complicated. The amount of information that the young doctor, and for that matter, the young nurse in nursing school, has to integrate in a relatively short time is enormous. What do they say about medical education? In the 4 years of medical education, medical students will learn 10,000 new words. We'll add 10,000 words to their vocabulary. The technology changes, the science changes. But medical ethics, the way I see it, is not a matter of teaching someone to be good rather than bad, because I take the optimistic assumption that most of the people entering medicine, entering nursing profession, entering the helping professions, begin with very good instincts and very strong positive character. And so it's not a matter of converting the the bad person to be a good person, but rather to say that in the modern practice of medicine, the doctor and the nurse, simply to be a good technical practitioner, has to know something about topics that are called ethics topics, things like informed consent, the relationship with patients, how to talk to patients, how to reach decisions with patients, confidentiality and privacy, issues about access to health care, questions about the affordability of medications and prescription drugs. Those are questions that are not exactly technical questions, and yet you simply can't practice medicine in the United States in 2006 unless you know something about that, as well as about good pain management, good end-of-life care, decisions that may have to be made at the end of life. These are part and parcel of being the good doctor or the good nurse these days. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of information that we try to transmit to the medical students. I'm sure nursing schools do it with their own students. Simply to improve the capability of the doctor and the nurse to practice good health care.
Yeah. I'm sure that there are certain things about being a physician that have not changed since medicine started. Well, to go at least back to the Greeks, I guess.
I don't go back that far.
Oh, I know you don't personally go back far. And there are certain basic sets, a set of principles, things like we will do everything we can to preserve the dignity and the autonomy of the patient. What we will place the patient's interest first. First, do no harm.
Good.
We're going to try to provide the best care that we can, given what we know how to do to the patient. So those things, I would hope, have been a constant almost forever. Having said that, what really has changed?
Well, one of the things you took as a universal given going back forever, I think, is relatively new. That's that point you made about autonomy. That is the fact that the patient is not only central in the interaction with doctors and medicine, because the patient has always been in the center, but where the control of the decision rests. And what we've seen, even in my own practice lifetime, which is getting close now to 40 years, is we've seen a gradual evolution from what we called paternalistic medicine, in which the doctor would make choices for the patient, presumably in the patient's best interest, to a system in which patients increasingly own decisions. Sometimes we use a model of shared decision-making, in which the doctor and the patient work collaboratively as partners, but with the sense that the ultimate, the final decision about what will be done for a patient in terms of an operation or medicine or any major decision is ultimately the patient's. And that evolution, in the last 40 or 50 years, has paralleled movements in our society and elsewhere in Western Europe of a kind of increased rights of citizens to make choices for themselves. I think it started with the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. It extended with the student rights movement, remember, of the late 60s and early 70s, the women's rights movement. Medicine has been caught up in this general evolution of people having more power to speak up against authority structures and to make their own wishes known and acted on.
Hmm. Well, what now I guess a lot of people would say is a basic principle in this change that you articulated. This basic principle that says the patient always has the right to refuse treatment. A patient could always say, yes, let's do this, or no, I'm not doing that.
Right.
Are there now a lot of situations where physicians feel conflicted between trying to honor that principle and then do what is their basic job, which is to apply the extent of their knowledge and their technology to to fix a person that is broken, you know, to the extent that that can actually happen. I mean, does that cause a lot of problems?
I don't know about a lot of problems. It causes some problems. I mean, if the physician, with all good intention, makes a recommendation that he or she thinks is in the patient's interest, and the patient then refuses to consider that or doesn't accept the recommendation, the physician is left with a sense of sadness. Sometimes it's more than sadness. Sometimes it borders on anger that my great scientific knowledge and technical abilities are not being accepted by the patient. But often the patient comes at the same situation from the patient's own belief structure and value structure, which may not be the same as the doctor's. Sometimes they disagree on religious grounds. Sometimes they disagree on cultural grounds. And sometimes they disagree just because two people may disagree, even when the facts are out there. That's nothing to do with religion or culture. They just right out disagree. Physicians have learned, are gradually learning, I don't think it's quite been fully assimilated yet, that the patient knows best with regard to the patient's choices and the patient's values, even though, as you say, it may be difficult for the physician to accept that. Mm-hmm.
Are there still times, though, that people have a difficult time, patients, have a difficult time making certain that what they want to happen actually happens? I think that still people are, even though people are increasingly encouraged to be active participants, to try to educate themselves to the extent that they can, to ask questions of their doctors, to say, now, wait a minute, why are we doing this? Explain to me what this is going to do. I think that there's still people are not quite sure whether their wishes will and have been followed.
I agree with that completely. You said a moment ago that when patients refuse the recommendation of doctors, recognize that refusal is to be honored. We didn't take account of the flip side of that, which is what happens when patients ask for things, that is, make positive requests of the system, not just saying no to what's proposed, but make positive requests of doctors. Are those requests honored? And I think that happens much less often. The doctor can say, well, to the patient, you know, you're asking me things that are medically inappropriate. You don't understand medicine. Or you're asking for things that may be medically inappropriate but socially not acceptable. And so the positive requests on the part of patients, of doctors in the system, are not honored nearly as the right of refusal that patients have.
Hmm. Maybe I should introduce again here our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Dr. Mark Siegler. He's a physician, professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Chicago, where he is also director of the McLean Center for Clinical Medical Ethics, and he has been since it was established back in 1984. He is here visiting the campus. He's going to give a talk in the MillerCom series talking about some of the ethical challenges that physicians face today and will face in the future. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center, the ballroom there on Lincoln Avenue in Urbana, and of course it's open to the public. Anyone here also listening can call and ask questions. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There have been some very, very significant changes in the way that healthcare is provided here in this country in recent decades. And here, that means that there is a party that enters into this process that has a third party here in between physicians and patients, and that are the frameworks in which the care is provided.
Sometimes known as payers.
Sometimes known as payers, yes, indeed. The people who are paying the bills. Is it the case now, do you think, that the physicians are finding it difficult, finding it more difficult to provide the care that they think is appropriate for their patients because of the fact that they're operating in institutions, HMOs, and other organizations where there are third-party payers who are making decisions about what kind of care will and will not be provided. I mean, are there cases where physicians experience, in a sense, sort of divided loyalties between what they feel to their patient and what they, and maybe what they're required to do as far as the person who is paying them and who is paying the bills is concerned?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's clearly the case. These things go in cycles. I mean, before Medicare, Medicaid in 1965, 66, poor people had to rely on charity to get medical care. After the Medicaid legislation of 66, which provided entitlements for people who lacked insurance, there was a much greater entry of poor people into the system. We saw in the HMO revolution of the late 80s, which carried on for about 15 years, efforts to actually limit the freedom of choice of patients and doctors. And these were middle-class people who had insurance often through their employment. Some of the most restrictive portions of managed care have gradually disappeared. I think these days we're at one part of the cycle where there remains oversight on the part of the payers about medical decisions. But to a surprising degree, physicians and patients still call the shots. Yesterday, I spent 10 minutes on the phone trying to get a very unusual PET scan, a positron total body PET scan on a patient with a history of cancer who came in with a suspicious-looking area. I had to talk to a nurse, and then the nurse referred me to a physician to authorize it for the insurance company. And it did take 10 minutes of my time, but both the doctor and the nurse I spoke to were entirely reasonable. Both understood why I wanted to do the test. And finally, they gave me the requisition number. The importance of that number is it meant that the insurance company would pay for the procedure and the patient would not be billed. These are expensive procedures. They cost a few thousand dollars, and I didn't want to saddle a patient with such a bill. So it took me a few minutes to get it done, but people are reasonable, and you can get that done. Mm.
Well, I was looking at the list of some of your publications, and one thing here that just really jumped right off the page for me that I thought was pretty interesting is apparently something you wrote, a paper you wrote titled "Lying for Patients: Physician Deception of Third Party Payers."
Oh no, did I write that?
Yes, I think you did. But I
managed to repress that paper.
I am certain though that physicians, you know, you have a physician that's in this position where you sincerely believe that a particular procedure is what that patient needs, that patient, their quality of life will be better, they will be healthier, it's important, they should have it. And, you know, for some reason the HMO doesn't, or whoever's paying, they don't want to do it. And you know, there's a way that I can, by arriving at a particular diagnosis or by saying something, I can write down something that will say, this person needs this, you pay for it, we're doing it. And, you know, maybe that involves a little bit of fudging. So well, what do you do? You know, you're a doctor, what do you do?
Over the last 10 years, recommendations for certain kinds of cancer screening tests have changed. I'm referring now to recommendations for mammograms for women over the age of 40, recommendations for colonoscopy, who can get a screening colonoscopy, how old you have to be, and whether or not you need a family history of colon cancer to do it. A lot of us believed, let's say 10 years ago, that an annual mammogram for women over the age of 40 was a reasonable test. A lot of us believed 10 years ago that a screening colonoscopy after the age of 50 was not unreasonable. You can cure colon cancer if you screen people and find polyps that then later become cancers. You can cure this disease. I'm actually making an announcement to the public that everybody should get a screening colonoscopy.
Get the test.
But in those days, 10 years ago, the recommendation was that you had to be 65 to get a screening colonoscopy. And gradually, the age recommendation dropped down to 60, and then a few years later to 55, and then finally where it is now at 50. So I guess in those years when I was believing that the best patient care would be to screen early, even though the recommendations were such that patients would not get reimbursed for it, I might have occasionally fudged on whether the patient had a family history in order to let the patient qualify. This had not, I don't do these procedures. It's not money in my pocket. Mm-hmm. But again, it was something that I thought was medically necessary and that I thought was in the patient's interest.
You know, in a particular case, and I have a caller here, I promise okay. them, I'm going to wait too long. In a particular case like that, it just seems to me that it shouldn't be, and now perhaps that has changed, but it should not be that difficult a sell to go to the administrators of a healthcare organization and say, now look, either you can pay $1,000 now for the colonoscopy, or later you're going to spend a lot, if this person gets cancer, we're going to spend a whole lot more money later treating this person.
Correct.
Why is that so difficult to say, let's spend the $1,000 up front. Down the road, if we can prevent cancer, it's going to save us money.
I think the reason is that the number of people you have to do the screening test on is a very large number of people to detect and prevent, let's say, one cancer. For that individual whose cancer you have prevented, the value of that is astronomical. But for a system that has to pay for all of the screening tests in order to find, whatever, 1 in 100 positives, they will stick with policies that come from federal and national guidelines before they will take on the additional economic burden of screening more and more people.
Oh, so then it sounds like actually if we're doing it the way we should, we might not save money? Because if we screen everybody, then obviously all those people aren't going to go on to have cancer.
That's correct. That's correct. You have to screen a lot more people than you will identify people with cancer. Hmm.
Let's talk with the caller here. Someone yeah. here where we are, Champaign-Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yes. I was in this age of shared medical decision-making, does the physician lose or does the physician give up a certain responsibility, and does the physician distance himself from the medical outcome of the patient, and is it easier to practice medicine because of that?
Wow, that's a hard question. It's a great question. I think, as your question implies, shared decision-making does mean that there would presumably be shared responsibility for outcome.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that that the physician is not autocratically dictating what the patient should or shouldn't do, but rather is engaging in discussion that leads to a mutually agreed upon decision,
mm-hmm.
It would seem that both parties should be prepared to celebrate successes, but also both parties have to carry the burden or the responsibility if the decision turns out not to be ideal and things go bad down the road. I've actually not thought about that before, but I think your question is right on target. I don't think that it should change the physician's involvement and commitment to the patient or the process of decisions, because mm-hmm. the physician is the one who has to structure and provide the information that will serve as the basis for the patient's choice ultimately.
Absolutely.
It's a fabulous question. You had something else to say.
I was going to ask, could you foresee the physician becoming a mere information specialist, providing the patient with the interpretation of the medical literature and then allowing the patient to make the decision almost on their own. You know, if we are moving towards a center of patient autonomy, full patient autonomy, could the physician play only that role as the information specialist?
I think it's a risk in a system that increasingly emphasizes autonomy and rights, that you could move in that direction. In fact, if you think about the availability of medical information now on the web through all sorts of medical sites, it's not unusual for patients to come into a physician's office these days knowing a great deal about their own condition and about alternatives and options. I would hope that medicine will not move in the direction that physicians see themselves entirely as offering people a menu. You know, here are six different dinner choices, and it's all the same to me if you choose salmon or steak or pork chops. I mean, well, what difference does it make to the waiter which one of those you choose? It does, you know, as long as you're happy with your choice. I would hate to see a situation in which physicians felt like, okay, you know, I've provided the menu of choices, I've provided the information, and it's all the same to me if you choose choice one, two, or three, when it isn't the same to the physician. The physician has a stake in this too, and really has a feeling often that one choice is a better choice for the patient, at least for the patient's physical health. It may not be the better choice in terms of the patient's entire value and belief system, but I would hate to see the physician evolve into a kind of technician who merely offered options and then withdrew without any value commitment to one or the other option.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's a great question. Thank you.
I'm to hang for a moment with this question of, if you have shared decision-making, does that also then, if there's a bad outcome, does that also mean that there's shared blame? And in fact, does that make it easier? Say you're a physician, does that make it a little easier for you to deal with the fact that there might be a bad outcome? I still have this feeling that no matter how much the decision-making is shared, that if there's a bad outcome, that the tendency is going to be to blame the physician. It's going to say, well, yeah, okay, maybe we shared decision-making, but you are the doctor. And I would also expect that the physician, he or she, would feel that responsibility. They would somehow feel, well, I'm the doctor. I'm the person who had the hands on the patient. Yes, there might have been some conversation about what to do, but I would imagine that person still, at the end of the day, they would still feel, if things went badly, they would somehow feel it was their fault.
I think you're right. I think the physician would feel that way and ought to feel that way, should feel that way. But let me take your case to an extreme. Imagine a patient who is a religious Jehovah's Witness who came in with a need for blood, whatever, perhaps a stomach ulcer was bleeding. And blood would be the recommended treatment of choice, and it would decrease the possibility that the patient would have a heart attack or a stroke or would die if you could give the blood. But then imagine that the patient was entirely mentally competent and said, I understand your point of view to the doctor, but you have to understand that my religious beliefs are such that if I accept blood, it means that I lose the possibility of being saved after death and going to heaven, and therefore I'm rejecting it. It's not that I don't believe everything you've told me about the risks that I'm taking for heart attack, stroke, and death, but I want you to understand that there are some things in my life that may be even more important than that. So imagine a doctor who, if the patient were not a Jehovah's Witness, would do everything he or she could to get the transfusion done. But here you have a doctor who says, well, I've got the medical call to give blood, but I've I've got the value and belief system, which tells me to respect a patient and respect the patient's values. And even though the risks I laid out are real, in this case, the person does not want blood and is willing to accept the risk. Now, if that, let's say that patient, in fact, got into a crisis, had a heart attack, maybe even died, I don't think the doctor would walk away from a case like that feeling blameless, like everything is perfect. I think the doctor would be troubled and sad. But on the other hand, the doctor would recognize that he or she respected the patient and the patient's values and allowed the patient to make a fundamental choice for themselves. So the doctor, I'm not sure the doctor would sleep easily that night, but there would be some notion that the outcome was a jointly responsible between the doctor and the patient.
Let's talk with someone over in Terre Haute in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Yes, hello, doctor. I don't know where to begin even.
Could I tell you one thing?
Yes.
My father-in-law, my wife's father, was born in Terre Haute in 1894.
Well, God bless him. Okay.
He died about 7 or 8 years ago, but I actually have gone back to Terre Haute and seen his birthplace.
Okay. Well, yeah. I'm actually a pilgrim in these parts.
Oh.
I'm from the East originally. But in any event, I have a somewhat jaded view of the medical system, and I see you as a very wise and compassionate person. But and for example, you've remarked that some things that were considered dogma 5 or 10 or 20 years ago have changed towards the direction of doing more screening and more testing and at earlier ages and so on. And it seems to me there's a counter trend to that that we don't hear too much about. The payoff of extensive screening is not warranted in terms of the result. I'm not sure what kind of question to ask you specifically, but what about the notion that we spend so much on health care and yet the result in this country is not as good as it is in other places where they have a universal payer system?
I think that's a great question. Let me just put some numbers behind your question. On absolute levels, the United States spends more, of course, than any other country in the world.
Yes.
Something like close to $2 trillion a year these days.
Yes.
On a per capita basis, we spend 50% more per person than the next country behind us, which is Canada, and 100% more per person than most of the countries in Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're up to something close to 15 or 16% of the gross national product now is going into the medical field. And as your question says, despite that, we first of all have health outcome statistics, things like newborn mortality,
yes,
life expectancy,
mm-hmm,
that are put us in the maybe around 20 to 25 among the countries of the world. And your question didn't say something else, but I'm sure it's in the back of your mind.
Yes.
Despite spending all this money, we have absolutely the worst access statistics of any country in the world.
Yes.
We are the only country, now that South Africa has developed universal health insurance, the only developed country that does not have universal access to health care. The latest numbers of 46.5 million Americans without health insurance probably underestimate the real number. There was a study that came out last year from a family health group that showed that in the year 2003-2004, throughout that 12-month period, there were 80 million, 80 million Americans
yes.
who at one time during that particular calendar year lacked insurance. Now, how did we get there? I mean, how do you get to spend more than anybody else and have the worst access and just sort of mediocre outcomes? It's a staggering question. The question is, are Americans, I don't know what, dumber than any other country in the world? I mean, that's one possibility. Or are we dealing with a democratic system in which only the best is good enough? You know, there are no halfway measures. It's all or none. Progress and high technology are, everybody gets it. If you get into the system, you get all the technology there is to offer. You have a system that believes, as we talked earlier, about autonomy and rights. So individual claims are taken very seriously, and you tend not to have a system that denies individual rights. On the other hand, you have another belief in a system of fairness and justice, which goes back to the beginning of this republic, so that you believe that everybody gets it. It's such a set of political paradoxes that have taken us here.
Ethical, but, too.
Ethical. I mean, when I'm asked about what the two big ethical problems are in American medicine of 2006, and I'm not going to rank them 1-2 because I believe both of them are of equal importance. One of them is access to health care. It is simply unethical and unjust that 46 million Americans should not have access to the system, many of them actually children. You know, Illinois is one of the states that has tried to improve access. Massachusetts has developed some universal access. But these are just state by state, but as a country. And the second central ethical problem is pain, the inadequate treatment of pain, all kinds of pain, chronic pain, pain in people who are terminally ill, even pain in people who are post-operative, you know. We should be able to do better as a clinical matter, pain management, and then as a societal level, access to health care strike me as the two most powerful ethical issues today. Now, there are plenty of other ones, but those are my big two.
Yes, well, I'm afraid we're not going to come up with a simple solution.
No.
And things will get worse before they get better, I'm afraid. But if all of those people who are not insured acquired insurance and started using the services, the high-tech services of the current, you know, what's available, we'd be down the tubes economically. I mean,
it's a great question. Now, it is the belief of many that when you take a careful look at those 46 million,
yes.
and there are breakdowns on their age and their socioeconomic character and so on, many of them would not turn out to be high utilizers of health care, which is to say that they generally are under the age of 50, many of them employed, and by and large healthy. So, but there probably would be 10 million chronically ill people in that group of 46 million who would themselves be much greater users of health services than they are today because they don't have insurance.
I appreciate all the time you're taking. I'm coming with something specific. One thing I've noticed, for example, I had a physician who actually told me that I can't continue to have you as a patient. Why? My jaw dropped. I never heard of such a thing. He said, well, I'm not doing anything for you. And I think the nub of it was that there are certain things that I decline to have done. For example, we noticed that my cholesterol was up a bit, a little bit over around 200, let's say, and he wanted to put me on statins. Well, but, you know, there are lifestyle questions, diet, you know, exercise and so on, and these don't even come up for discussion. It seems like automatically, you know, a prescription is written for something that costs $100, $150 a month, without any discussion of things that the patient can do to improve his own situation.
Well, now that this the point you're making right now sort of reinforces this discussion we had earlier with the other caller about shared decision making. I mean, this issue about choosing or not choosing a statin and choosing lifestyle modification as an alternative approach is precisely the kind of decision that ought to be made by doctors and patients communicating and discussing and looking at the medical details and facts. Frankly, if you and your doctor can't reach agreement on an issue like that, as you said, you're no longer seeing that doctor. Doctors and patients have to be able to share these decisions and reach agreements and accommodations all the time about matters like statins and other matters that come up. I really appreciate your call.
I hope that the caller will forgive me. We just have about 5-6 minutes left. I have another call I'd like to try to get in the time that remains. And we'll just go there to our caller here in Champaign County, line 1, right here. Hello.
Hi. I didn't realize that there was so little time. I had a couple of things, and I'll probably just focus on the one. The point that you just made about the complexity, though, it seems to me there's one figure when we talk about the how much healthcare expense is, how much higher it is in the U.S., we should always mention the inefficiency figure. And actually, the government control run system, Medicare and Medicaid, has a much higher efficiency than the private sector in this case. And maybe people don't like to hear that, but it's apparently true. And if you were to say this much of the healthcare expense is actually going to actual healthcare, and this much is going to overhead and inefficiencies in deciding whether to turn you down. I actually was going to ask you sort of a cross-cultural question.
Yeah.
About why, you know, we talk about the best healthcare system in the world, but I've been hearing about surgery rooms in Europe where they have entirely non-metallic devices, and they can do real-time imaging of perhaps my ankle while they're cutting through it, so that they have a different priority. They actually want to bring this, and I don't think there's one of these in this country yet. So I don't know if you want to react to that. I had another question about how operations are actually authorized or when one has a proficiency to do an authorization, because I understand that our arterial catheterization with the balloon catheterization, I guess it's called, that was some years ago. This goes back some years. That there was no like sort of standard policy, in that they left it to the orderlies because the doctors didn't want to do it. Does that make any sense? I maybe you could focus on the first part, I guess.
I think I'm gonna the thing about the surgical techniques. I just don't know much about the balloon catheter or the European imaging stuff, but your first point about the inefficiencies of the system, I think are very important. We have hundreds upon hundreds of private insurance companies that are providing health insurance to people, and as you said, the government system, whether state-run or federally run, is far more efficient in terms of decreasing overhead and decreasing expenditures on administrative costs. That's clearly the case. There was a time when there was a joke made of showing the skyline of Boston and saying, well, you know, what is the most expensive healthcare institution in Boston, of which has many healthcare institutions? And the trick answer was the Prudential Insurance Company, which provided the money to provide all the health care for these different fancy medical schools and hospitals. Managed care, I mean, if managed care did one thing effectively, it really forced many institutions and many insurance companies, for that matter, to decrease the overhead and the administrative costs. It did that reasonably well over a 10-year period, but the general point you make is a good one. I mean, the outcome of your point is we need something better, and we probably could be more efficient with some sort of universal payer system than the current hodgepodge of payers that we now have. Whether the American free enterprise system would ever allow you to eliminate those 500 other insurers is really the political question that I think the next administration is going to be wrestling with for quite a while.
Did you want to do a quick follow-up?
It is the thing that's taken. Just pointing out that Medicare Part D is a further extension of this, and the competition was you know, it just seems that looking at healthcare as a commodity that can be bought and traded and on the market is erroneous, and we'd have to disabuse ourselves of that notion. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, it seems that it's perfectly appropriate we're talking about these things, obviously, because you said at one point that access to care was, as far as you were concerned, one of the two big medical ethical issues, the other being pain control, access to care. So it's perfectly appropriate we're talking about this. It seems that one of the really difficult things is here now, if we get to the point, say tomorrow we put in place a system of national health care like they have in Canada, which is the one that some people think it would be good for the United States. I think that those people who didn't get health care before but are getting it now, maybe they're going to be very happy. But the people who are not going to be happy are the people who now are in an HMO, and where it seems to me there will have to be, hesitate to use the word rationing, but, we are going to have to get to the point where we're going to have to, as the last caller said, we're going to have to disabuse people of the notion that you can have all of the health care you want simply by asking for it. And maybe the toughest place to deal with this is going to be at end of life, where we're spending most of the money that we spend in the last few months of a person's life.
Be careful about those numbers.
Maybe that's not
extrapolations. But we clearly something like 15-20% of the Medicare budget goes to support people in their last year of life. Of course, we often don't know that it's the last year of a person's life when we are spending that money. But there are cases, of course, of the sort that you're describing, when the handwriting is on the wall and the cost of end-of-life care is very high. The group at Dartmouth under Dr. Wenberg has done an atlas of health services, including end-of-life care, and has shown enormous variation. I mean, there are, for example, 100 hospitals in Chicago, and the Wenberg group can track how many days patients spent in their last 3 months of life in intensive care units, how many consultants they saw in the last 3 months of life, and how much expenditures were made in the last 3 years of life. These are often Medicare expenditures. And they show extraordinary variability, even within a single city like Chicago or New York or Los Angeles, and how to bring most of the institutions in conformity, let's say, with the lower quarter or lower third, would itself be an extraordinarily efficient move. That has not taken place, and it will be difficult unless we have, as I say, move away from multiple payers.
Yeah. We're pretty much at the point we have to finish. I don't know what makes this question pop into my mind, but given the difficulties of practice these days, I'm sure that there are physicians, older physicians, who might say, you know, if I had to do it over again, I might not be a doctor. I can't imagine that you had ever thought such a thing, or maybe you did. Is it harder, do you think, to be a doctor now?
I think it's harder to be a doctor than it was when I started 40, 45 years ago. But there's no work in the world that I would have preferred to do. I tell my students that there are very few jobs where you work very hard during the day, and at night you come home and to whatever time it is, and you put your feet up and you say, you know, I spent my whole day doing my best to help people, and I can't believe that they even pay me to do that. And I didn't try to do anything wrong or bad to people. And it's just a very fulfilling career. And I see the young people going into it now, and they are as motivated and as enthusiastic as I was many years ago.
Well, there we'll have to finish up. I'm sure many of these issues we will come back to again other days with other guests. Our guest this morning, Dr. Mark Siegler. He's the Lindy Berman Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. He's a professor in the Department of Medicine. He's also director of the McLean Center for Clinical Medical Ethics that was established in 1984. And at that time, he was appointed the director and has been since. He is here on the campus to give a talk on bioethical challenges in a 21st century world. And it is part of the MillerCom series. They are all open to the public and free. Anybody who would like to attend should feel welcome. It's a lecture that's being held in conjunction with the College of Medicine's 35th anniversary celebration. And this will be this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the ballroom of the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on South Lincoln Avenue in Urbana, and anybody who was interested in attending should feel welcome. And Dr. Siegler, thank you very much.
Dave, thanks so much.